inspiration for me usually happens in two ways. Either it doesn't come at all, or it hits me over the head. This week, I was trying to look for a fresh insight into the work and witness of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and I had just reread his sermon, Love Your Enemies, when a friend passed on an article from the New York Times Magazine from a couple of years ago called Forgiven. People send me lots of things, and so when I received this, I, you know, thought I'd probably triage it into the, you know, when I have spare time file. But this friend doesn't usually send things, and she said, you have got to read this now. And the now was what was important to me. So I did. I opened it up, and it ended up being one of the most important articles that I've read in the last 20 years. What I ended up reading was indeed a powerful, rich article that highlights in graphic, pragmatic detail. I'm going to move back to my water. Sorry, friends. This article details in graphic, pragmatic detail the power of King's vision of the beloved community. It's a vision rooted in the Beatitudes, which I read. It's a vision that wasn't just about nonviolence, but also about living together pragmatically as God envisions us to live. A vision that calls us to look beyond easy answers to grace and mercy and forgiveness. The story goes like this. Several years ago, a 19-year-old young man named Connor turned himself in to the Tallahassee, Florida Police Department. He called them, asked them to come get him, because he had just shot his fiance, Anne, whom he had been dating for the last 3 years. He thought she was dead, but she wasn't. She would end up holding on for several days. As she lay in the hospital, her father kept holding her hand and praying and listening. And even though she was in a coma, he kept hearing her voice say, "Forgive him." His inner voice shouted back, "No." But he kept hearing his dying daughter's voice, "Forgive him." Because Anne and Connor had been so close, their families were close too. When Connor's parents heard what had happened, they were literally sick, having to pull over on the freeway several times to get sick. But they followed their instincts to go to the hospital anyway, to support Anne's family. When they arrived, their fathers hugged. Though Anne's dad was self-aware enough to say, "Thank you for being here, but I might hate you by the end of the week." In retrospect, he says, "I knew that we were somehow together on this journey." Connor felt that too. When he was booked and asked to list 5 people who would be allowed to visit him, he included not only his parents, but Anne's mom as well. She didn't want to visit at first, but she realized that before this had happened, she had loved Connor too. She knew that if she defined Connor by that one moment, murder, she was also defining her daughter by that one moment, murder victim. so she decided to visit. She asked her husband if he had a message for Connor. And he said he realized that it was not just Anne asking him to forgive Connor, that it was Jesus Christ asking that as well. He goes on, since I'd never said no to Jesus before, I wasn't going to start then. So he told his wife to pass on the message to Connor that he loved him and that he forgave him. Looking back, Anne's parents say that Connor owed them a debt that he could never repay. And releasing him from that debt would release them from expecting that anything in this world would satisfy them. That bears repeating. They understood that releasing him from that debt would release them from the expectation that anything in this world could satisfy them. If we fast forward 2 months to Anne's parents' first meeting with the prosecutor, the state's attorney, Jack Campbell, he explained that the criminal justice process includes mandatory sentencing, the fact that in Florida, the first-degree murder usually carries a life sentence or potentially even the death penalty. Then he pointed out a little-known fact that the state attorney has broad discretion to depart from mandatory sentences. As the person tasked with finding justice for Anne, he could reduce charges and seek alternative sentences. He told them that if he wanted to give Connor 5 years for manslaughter, he could do that. That made Anne's mother sit up very straight. And so very quickly, Campbell assured her that he wouldn't do that. What he didn't understand was that Anne's parents didn't want Connor to spend the rest of his life in prison. The prosecutor's latitude gave Anne's parents an unexpected challenge. It was easy to think, oh, poor Connor, I wouldn't want him to spend his life in prison, but that's how the system works. Now, because of knowing about that latitude, now the prosecutor was telling them that he doesn't have to. And so it made Anne's parents have to ask, what exactly was it that they did want to advocate for? As they were grappling with what this might mean, a friend from church told them about a process called restorative justice. Some of you may know of it. It's a practice that is used in many cities here in Wisconsin. This process considers the harm done, and it strives for reparation of that harm instead of merely punishing someone for a crime that they've committed. Most often it's done in what's called a restorative community conference, in which the offender, the victim, and a representative, or sometimes even multiple representatives of the community, come together to talk about the crime, its effects, and then come to a consensus about how to repair the crime. Usually it's applied to less serious crimes, like property offenses where stolen property can actually be returned or vandalized material can be replaced. It's never used in capital cases, never in gun cases, and never in Florida. Through tenacity and perseverance and creativity, Anne's parents found a restorative justice expert to help them. Then, through even more tenacity, perseverance, and creativity, they convinced the prosecuting attorney to allow for a restorative justice circle Though he says that he made them understand flat out that he would not be bound by what they decided in this conference. The day of the conference, Anne's parents got there first, then Connor's. The state's attorney was in the circle. The restorative justice expert had set up a chair to represent Anne with her favorite blanket and her Thespian of the Year award and a picture of her sticking her tongue out at the camera. They said it felt like she was in the room. Then Connor was led into the room. And for the first time in 15 months, he was able to hug his parents. Anne's parents talked first. Her mom told of nursing her, about how she was born with a lazy eye, that they worked really hard to help her to overcome so that she would be able to drive and lead a full life. And about how all of that seemed a little pointless now. There were no kid gloves, none. It was really tough, way tougher than what a judge would say. The prosecutor says that it was absolutely excruciating and traumatic. The last person to talk was Connor. He told of how he and Anne had been fighting for 3 days, how at one point in the fight, he had been so upset with himself that he wanted to kill himself. And so he went to his dad's closet, got down a gun off the shelf, went into the den to unlock the bullets from their closet. And he told how, after having done that, they started fighting again. And he killed the girl he loved. He didn't try to shirk any responsibility. He said that there were no excuses, no reason. His mother, sitting right next to him, said it was absolutely life-changing and awful to hear her son telling this, to know so profoundly that it was her son who did this. His father told the group that if he had ever thought that his gun would have harmed another person, he would never have had it. After everyone had spoken, it was time to try to come to consensus about restitution. Anne's parents, when they went in, had planned to ask for a 5-year sentence. But after hearing the details, they asked for 10 to 15. Connor said that he didn't think he should have a say. Later, the prosecutor, who had expected his boss to never sign off on less than 40 years, recommended 20. And that was what Connor ended up being sentenced. He says that because of their forgiveness, he has had to be honest about his responsibility without being condemned or abandoned or hated. The prosecutor says, we got a chance to look more deeply at the root of where this behavior came from. And it was a much more nuanced conversation than a trial would ever have allowed for. Anne's mother says that everything that she is able to feel, she can feel because they forgave Connor. She says that they can be sad and often still are. They can be in pain, but they don't have to stay stuck in the ugliness. Forgiveness for them is self-preservation. It gives them the emotional distance to be able to grapple with their grief without it pulling them under. With the Beatitudes, that gospel passage that I read, and the prophets, and Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., all of them advocated for a way of being that was not only nonviolent, but that brought about the beloved community. This story, more than any that I have heard in my adult life, shows two families and a DA taking the hard route and continuing to treat one another as children of God, even when they have been wronged in the most vile possible way. The basis of the creative nonviolent movement is rooted in the reality that seeking to destroy our enemy destroys us too. Church members often ask me how we apply creative nonviolence to larger systemic perpetrators of evil, like the Hitlers and the Pol Pots. And I'll say, you know, I don't know. But what I do know is that in our lives and in our homes and in our city, we are being called to be about forgiveness and humanization and restoration of all. And when we do that, as Dr. King understood so powerfully, it will set us free. And then all of us will be able to join Dr. King in saying, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." May it be so. Amen.